You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 23rd, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, Kara, did you get that picture I texted to you over the weekend?
I did. It looks snowy. Yeah.
So, every now, we had an ice storm, you know, which actually scuttled my plans to go to Arizona because the airport was closed down on Sunday. Yeah, it was unfortunate. So I apologize to all those Arizona skeptics who were planning on seeing me on Saturday night. I couldn't make it. But it's a good thing. It's a good thing because the airport, you know, was hit hard. And also, we lost power on Sunday.
That's the worst.
For about 24 hours. Well, it's worse when it's like negative 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah. And
so I had to like keep the home fires burning literally to keep the house from freezing.
Yikes.
The last thing I need is the pipes to freeze and have another flood in my house.
Oh, had you had your cords of wood already chopped?
I did. Basically, the trees from the tornado, I chopped into wood and burned that for the ice storm. So that's how that worked. But yeah, about once a year or so, we get this thing where during the day, it's just warm enough to rain. And then at night, it freezes. And then you get this, like, everything, all the trees, everything is covered with crystal, you know, and it's gorgeous.
Especially it's a remarkable sight.
If it's sunny the next day, which it was, it's gorgeous, but it's also high risk for power outage because the ice on the trees breaks a lot of branches and they fall onto the power lines, and there you go. So, yeah, so we lost our power. So what's interesting is that, you know, so I'm essentially off of the internet for a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then
How are you not insane right now?
I know. So it's you know, usually I'm pretty much plugged into anything that's going on. And I didn't learn about the whole Covington hubbub.
Oh, God.
At the Lincoln Memorial until Tuesday. And it had already gone through the whole cycle. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't following it in real time. I just heard about it in retrospect after it had already all gone down.
Although, to be fair, I feel like the cycle is still cycling.
It is. But
it shall always cycle.
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be any ultimate resolution to this, but it is interesting. So if you haven't heard about the Covington student confrontation at the Lincoln Memorial, we're not going to actually go into the details of that because it's this thorny political mess.
Right.
But and if you just Google it, and so again, most people who are writing about it are writing about it like, well, you know about this if you weren't living in a cave all weekend or you lose your power.
The equivalent of a cave.
Yeah, basically. But what's interesting is like now that it's gone through this cycle, like a lot of people are talking about the lessons, sort of the meta lessons from this. And it is kind of a national skeptical moment, although I don't really know how many people are going to appreciate that. But
not enough.
But I think the meta lessons here are like some are obvious and a lot of people are talking about it. Don't rush to judgment, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to form an instant gut reaction opinion about something, especially when you've clearly just heard one side, you know, or you've heard about it from a limited perspective. And in this case, the limited perspective was both literal and metaphorical because it literally had to do with the perspective of the video that you were watching of the event.
Yeah, like what edited version you saw.
Yeah, what slice of the time of the events that you were watching. But also, when we were chatting about this, Kara, you brought up as well, it's always more complicated than it seems.
Oh, right? Yes. And nothing's ever as clean as you think it is, especially if you don't take the time to understand the perspective of all of the constituents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something we say that a lot. It's always more, however complicated you think it is, it's probably more complicated than that. But also, the other thing is, which I don't hear anybody talking about, but this is the kind of thing we write about in our book, is the fundamental attribution error, right? Do you guys remember that? So
yes.
Essentially, we are quick to judge other people's actions as if they are entirely due to internal factors while looking for external factors to explain our own actions. So it's easy to look at these events and say, oh, like these kids are acting this way because of their personality, their traits, rather than them reacting to the situation or whatever, that anybody here was, they're doing this because of how they are. You make a moral judgment about the person rather than trying to understand the situation that they're responding to, you know, the external factors that may be influencing that. Doesn't mean that there aren't any internal factors. It's that you have to always look at that in the context of the external factors. And this gets back to the principle of charity that we were talking about last week, that, you know, when confronted with something like this, the first thing you should do is just slow down, you know, and back up and say, all right, this is clearly a complicated situation. I want to hear, you know, multiple perspectives, mitigating factors as fairly as I can before I come to any kind of judgment of what's going on, especially when you're being handed a story that fits hand in glove with your pre-existing narrative.
Oh, yes.
That's very good point.
Out the wahoo.
So important.
Right. Yep.
Unfortunately, there's still a lot of that going on. There's still a lot of people saying, see, this completely supports my pre-existing narrative.
Well, and that's the funny thing is that even after the full, you know, video has come to light or you've seen it from multiple angles, basically everybody's just doubling down on what they originally thought. And so it just shows you why it's so important, especially when in a world of like fake news, that's a word that's been really like used in the description of this specific phenomenon or this specific video. It just shows you why it's so important to look at things outside of your own echo chamber. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like if you're only ever reading the news from the sites that you think, you know, that you like because they reconfirm what you already believe,
right,
you're never going to get all the context. You're just not. And that's why it's important to see, you know, see what a lot of different people are saying about these things, read op-eds and look at it from multiple perspectives so that you can have a more well-rounded understanding of a situation and not just one that's kind of through a peephole.
I find it incredibly fascinating when you look at you're looking at social media and you're seeing all these different people commenting on the same thing. Mm-hmm. And this news item was a real eye opener for me because, you know, getting like certain people's perspectives on the news item, you know, whatever the ultimate truth is, you know, you're getting it filtered through person A, person B, person C, and a lot of different things happened. One, you know, some people dug their heels in to the nth degree on both sides of the fence, right? You get the far right and the far left that are just like going to go ape shit on it and say, no, it's the way that I need it to be, right?
And that, what's interesting, Jay, before you go on, when you point that out, some people say, oh, you're giving me this both sides-ism, like it's all equivalent. It's like, no, we're not saying that. We're not saying there's nothing moral that you could say about how people act in this situation. But it is true that people from various perspectives are looking at this through the filter of their pre-existing worldview. There's just no doubt about that.
Although, to be fair, some
people did moderate their opinion. They do have a more nuanced opinion when all the facts came out. But I don't think people's fundamental perspectives have changed.
So, Steve, what does it say about me when I watch something like this and my takeaway is everybody is horrible? What is my worldview?
Yeah.
You're closer to the truth.
Well, it could be cynical, you know, and it's easy to get cynical when things like this happen.
And that's fine, Tara. That's fine.
Thank you, Bob.
To finish my thought.
Don't enable her. Go ahead, Jay.
This is the important part of what I wanted to say. I saw skeptics apologizing on social media for misrepresenting what their gut reaction was to that news feed, which I thought was really honest. You know, it was a really good thing for people to do, to go back and say, hey, I, you know, yesterday or 2 days ago, I wrote this, said this. Saw multiple people do that. And there was a pattern to it. You know, it wasn't just one oddball person. That many people, skeptics, were editing themselves and saying, you know what, I was wrong. Because we can admit to being wrong, because we can have an emotional reaction and we can have a rational reaction, and those two don't have to be forever intermixed.
So that's great, but the real test is what they do next time, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the next time this happens, so they go, oh, wait a minute, I should really hold off here and try to look at this from a neutral perspective until more facts come out or till the other side has an opportunity to explain their context or whatever was going on. But the one thing I think is not going to happen, I don't think the media is going to change one bit as a result of this, because I just think the forces at work, there's too much incentive to be the first to have a reaction.
That's right. Yeah.
Outrage drives clicks, and I think they don't care. Because they think, and I know this partly from personal experience with reporters who have dealt with issues where the initial reporting was totally wrong, And then they make the correction. And you know what? That's just double clicks for them, right? Because they get to get all the clicks from the original outrage. Then they get the clicks from correcting the original reporting that was wrong. And they just double dip. It's amazing that I don't see any incentive for them to change.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, I think, what's an important conversation to be had, right? Because I don't think what we're doing is we're not, or at least I can't speak for you, Steve, but I don't think we're like chastising the journalists involved in this, but we're talking about a much bigger machine that incentivizes reporting on something the second it happens with limited information and then iterating as they go, which doesn't always reverberate the most appropriate way throughout society. Because there have been studies that show, I mean, we've talked about this before on the show, that our initial reaction is the one that tends to hold the most weight.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And then when we do retractions or we make changes, those don't tend to affect our opinion as heavily as that very first reaction. Yeah. And that's the most problematic part of sort of the journalistic system that's in place right now, which is, you know, it's based upon ad revenue. And that's a big bummer because the more clicks, the more they can stay afloat.
Never forget, this is a business.
Yep.
Yeah, and social media is now driving a lot of this. You have to get that, you know, getting that initial video to go viral. That's all that really matters at the end of the day, right?
Yep.
Oh boy.
Yeah, and I just want to add that enjoy this time period. Just revel in the time period we're in now, because you know maybe the videos you saw wasn't representative of the full event, and you should seek out, you know, as much information as you can. But what you saw, even if it was a little snippet, actually happened. In the future, it's going to be far worse. Talk about fake news. It's going to be fake video. There's going to be video out there of events that in no way, shape, or form actually happened. So that's going to be an interesting but often not fun time. But so enjoy the video now that we know that it's at least mostly real.
Uh-oh, we'll need to develop some AI that can detect real fake algorithms and news and videos for us. They're going to have to help us.
It'll be warfare back and forth, you know, who's got the best algorithms and software
that's already happening. I mean, it's already pictures and videos that are fake go viral. They have their impact and then they get corrected down the road. But again, as Kara said, the impact is already had. It's too late.
And usually, I mean, the photos are much more effective right now. And so usually it's things like, look at the super blood moon. It's like, that's a fake picture. That's not really what it looked like last night.
Right, but we are on the cusp of
that's
video.
That's child's
being that
play.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right, that's all child's play. When you can make the president say or do anything that you want close up, realistically, that's a game changer.
It's going to be a game changer.
Yeah, right, think about this too, that, you know, if fake videos come out right before the election, it's going to have its effect before anyone has a chance to correct it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're right. I read an article about that recently about how we're basically there technologically being able to fake videos. And yeah, that's going to be a game changer and not in a good way. And it's not clear how we're going to be able to deal with that.
Yeah, maybe we want the Uncanny Valley to, you know, extend a little bit longer than we might originally have thought was good.
But you're right. At some point, fake video is going to be seamless. And there you go.
Yep.
That's really scary. You know, I think people felt kind of intimidated like about Photoshop, and now like everyone can use it and anybody can Photoshop pretty much anything.
The big difference now is that it costs millions and millions and millions of dollars to do this really well. We see it all the time with like actors being scanned in light scan equipment and then, you know, mapped onto other actors or onto their younger selves or their older selves, whatever the case may be. I said that weird. Mapped onto a different version of themselves in order to play, you know, some sort of cool creature or play themselves younger or whatever the case may be. It's just right now it's too expensive to have these kinds of viral videos online that are really, really, you know, convincing, but eventually it's not going to be too expensive.
Right, right.
That's the difference.
Sure. And if you have someone who's willing to invest millions of dollars for that purpose, they will go ahead and do it. Once it's
accepted. For sure. For something like election tampering, for sure.
Oh, yeah. That's worth it. To them, that's worth it.
And yeah, but at some point, you'll be able to do it on your cell phone.
No, totally. There will just be an app for it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, an app called Election Fixer, you know. but seriously, this is a threat to democracy when you think about it, because democracies are dependent upon the free flow of correct information, you know. Mm-hmm. And if we can't trust anything, how can we make decisions? How can we decide who to vote for? We can't trust on the information. We can't make informed decisions when it's so easy to misinform.
Yep.
Anyway.
Yeah, it's a problem.
Yeah. We always like to start the show on a high point. All right, Kara, you are going to premiere a new segment that we are going to test out on the SGU. That doesn't happen every day. It's going to sink or swim based upon your performance.
No!
Today,
that's so terrible.
And we are the judges.
I came up with this in 5 minutes. Just
the name of the segment
expectations.
We made market tested it. This has been extensively researched. The name of the segment is What Do You Know? So tell us
what you know. Yeah. This is kind of an amalgamation of some multiple suggestions by listeners when we were talking about coming up with new formats for the show. So, hey guys, what do you know? The idea here is you come across something in your, you know, daily readings, your studies, your whatever, and that you just didn't know before. And what a fun thing to share. So I want to hear these from you guys as well.
Yeah. This will be an everybody segment. Yeah.
One thing that I came across the other day, I'm also interested to hear if you guys already knew this, is that there is only one letter missing from the periodic table of elements. Do you know what it is?
Yes, because that was a trivia question that George did sprung on us. I think it's J, right?
Isn't it J?
It's J, but it's a little more complicated than that, because in current versions of the periodic table, there is also there's a letter missing, but it's
Q.
Why?
Yeah. The letter Q is not present in any elements right now, but in IUPAC nomenclature, there's a yet to be discovered element, number 114, and that one's called ununquadium or ununquadium. So as it stands, discovered elements, no Q, but even with undiscovered elements, no J anywhere. I tested it myself.
So the next name we give it needs to contain both Q and J.
Well, I read why this could be, you know, like that's just weird that there's no J anywhere on the periodic table. And it looks like most elements have Latin or Greek names, or they've been Latinized. Mm. And even though they're, and a lot of them come from the German first, and even though there are J's in German, like the original iodine was actually from the German name, so it was J-O-D, but it looks like it's just the letter J doesn't exist in Greek or Latin, and so that's why it doesn't seem to be there.
We'll name that next element Jaquinium,
right?
Cover both of them.
It's kind of cool, though, right? Did you guys know?
Qui-Gon Jinnium.
Steve knew this already. Jay, did you know this? Jay.
Yes.
Oh, hey. What do you know?
Your name is Jay.
That's why I remembered it. I knew it. Gotcha. Yeah, I remembered.
Dang it. Thought I might stump you guys. Something new to me. Maybe new to some of our listeners, but apparently not new to the rest of the SGU.
I liked it.
It's cool.
All right. Thanks, Kara.
Yep.
All right. We got some news items for you. Evan, apparently there is yet another measles hotspot.
Sure is.
Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
Hey, it's not us this time.
No, well, right. No more Disneyland issues, but up north in Portland, they're having a problem. And guess what it has to do with? I wonder why a hotspot for a measles outbreak has cropped up in the Portland area. What could possibly be the cause of that? Anti-vaccination, yes. And an emergency has been declared over the measles outbreak there. A quickly escalating measles outbreak, as they are reporting. And it's led health officials in nearby Clark County, Washington, to declare it as such a public health emergency. They are warning that people infected with the virus are highly contagious, and those who are unvaccinated are extremely susceptible. Since the beginning of this year, 2019, the measles virus has been confirmed in schools, churches, a dentist's office has had a confirmed case, an Amazon locker pickup station, a Costco, an IKEA, Concourse D of the Portland International Airport, and an infected person also attended a Portland Trail Blazers NBA basketball game on January 11th. The problem is, for those who are unvaccinated, they are very, very likely to catch this if they are in the vicinity of any of these places. And it's a real nasty, nasty virus, because you cough it up, someone who has it, it hangs out in the air just waiting to latch on to people and infect people who aren't protected. So at the beginning of last week, there were only a handful of confirmed cases. But by a week ago Friday, by the time this airs, it's a week ago Friday. That was the day the emergency was declared. There were 19 cases. 2 days later, the number grew to 21 cases. And Tuesday, which is yesterday from when we're recording this, it's 23 confirmed cases. So that's the latest number we have. Mm-hmm. 18 of these patients, 18 of the 23, are aged 1 to 10. 20 of the 23 have fallen ill. They've not been immunized against measles. And the vaccination history of the remaining three remain unverified. And there is currently one person in the hospital for it. So that is a pretty clear case of, you don't have the vaccination, you're the one who's going to be getting it, most likely.
You want to hear some measles stats?
Yeah.
In 2017, worldwide, 110,000 people died of measles.
Hmm.
That's a lot. The vaccine is estimated to have saved 21 million lives just since 2000 alone. In the U.S., measles was eliminated. Remember, eliminated means it's no longer endemic, but it still exists in the world, whereas eradicated means it's gone from the world. So it was eliminated in the U.S. in 2000. However, it has come back due to vaccine hesitancy, anti-vaccine views. It peaked in 2014. That was the Disneyland outbreak. You guys remember that? There were 667 cases in 2014. 2018 had the second highest at 349, and 2019 is not off to a good start.
Nope. Closer to home, Steve, this was reported January 8th. 55 people in Brooklyn, New York, in the areas of Williamsburg and Borough Park neighborhoods, they've fallen ill, along with 105 people in nearby Rockland County. And these are people within the Orthodox Jewish communities, and particularly children. They are the ones most susceptible. And they are also anti-vaccine propagandists. And they actually have people who go out and knock on doors and tell people the supposed dangers of vaccinations. And they're like actively trying to get people on door-to-door campaigns.
Wow. That is an SNL skit, right? You have somebody show up at the door, disease-ridden, coughing, with pops on their face, talking to you about the evils of vaccines.
Steve, is my MMR still good?
I don't know. When did you have it? It could have worn off by now.
When I was 12, like everybody.
You should get a booster.
Yeah.
I think that was my booster.
Well, you get three. That's a series. A booster's like 10 years later. If it's waning, you can get a booster. You know, if you were going to have kids or before you're going to be around people with kids or whatever, the recommendation would be for you to get a booster.
Okay.
The part of the reason for that outbreak among the Orthodox Jewish community, Evan, is because they do not vaccinate, but it's also because Israel is having a huge outbreak, and all of those outbreaks were imported from Israel.
Jeez.
But they still wouldn't have become outbreaks if it weren't for the fact that there was fertile ground, you know, that they were unvaccinated individuals.
Correct.
So it's still out there in the world, so you can't, we still have to protect ourselves from it. The beginning of the year, I just wrote about this on Science Based Medicine, the World Health Organization came out with their top 10 health threats worldwide, and one of them was vaccine hesitancy.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And I agree. I think that is a serious threat to the world's public health, and it's completely treatable.
This is all unnecessary.
It
drives you mad. You mad.
Wow. Yeah, they say that the World Health Organization says that vaccination across the board, not just measles, but vaccination across the board, prevents 2 to 3 million deaths a year, and another 1.5 million could be avoided if we were, globally all vaccinated. It's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. Clearly, it is the most cost-effective and most effective public health intervention ever devised.
Absolutely.
By medicine.
Agreed.
All right. Thanks, Evan. Bob, tell me about this new Atom Smasher.
Yeah, this, of course, really got my juices flowing. So new designs for the successor of the LHC, Large Hadron Collider, were released recently. The FCC, or Future Circular Collider, would be 100 kilometers long, 100 trillion electron volts, and be ready to go in a few decades. So, this is fascinating stuff. The first problem, of course, is the name, Future Circular Collider. Future? I mean, so does that mean that they would rename it when it opens? So that when
I
it opens...
just be the circular collider.
To the present.
Or just like the present.
Collider.
Yes, the present circular collider. Or the now
the
circular
day,
collider.
The modern day circular collider.
I think they needed a few more meetings to talk about the naming. They could have called it even the Super Hadron Collider. That's got a little bit more cachet, doesn't it? Or even, how about the Fraggin' Huge Hadron Collider?
I mean, Collider McCollider Face.
This is just a few minutes here. I'm coming up with better names than Future Circular Collider. But I'm used to this. Nobody takes my naming advice. Even my ex-wife, she wanted to, because I wanted to name our daughter Uhura or Large Magellanic Cloud, but she didn't want anything to do with that. So we're stuck with Ashley. Ashley's a great name. So yeah, so this is a thing. It's a cool thing. CERN, which we've mentioned on the show about a billion times, is a European Organization for Nuclear Research, is a consortium of 23 member nations. And so they came up with this conceptual design. So this conceptual design wasn't just written on a napkin and sent to the press. They vetted this. They went over this. 1,000 scientists for over 5 years worked on this. So this thing is well thought out. So you can probably bet a few bucks that if they do go ahead and do this, it would be very similar to what they've written down here. So let's see. It would be built near the LHC along the Swiss border and 100 kilometers around, huge, dwarfing the LHC. So there's like two parts to this, to the build. The first phase I will call phase one, kind of obvious. So this is going to cost 9 billion euros. Do the conversion if you want to know it in your local monetary system, but 9 billion euros, that's a lot of money in any country, and they think that could be up and going by 2040. Now, what this phase one is going to do, it's going to
come... That's a long time off, though. Wow.
Yeah, it is. Jay, 100 kilometers. This thing is massive. But what phase one will do will collide electrons and their antimatter doppelgangers, positrons. They will annihilate each other. But now if you took an electron and a positron and just kind of casually flung them together, and they would still annihilate, and you would get my favorite photons, gamma ray photons. But there's, of course, nothing low energy about the FCC. These things are going to be accelerated to high velocities. So when they annihilate, they're going to create lots of things like B mesons and W and Z bosons. And included in that, of course, and probably the main reason, definitely the main reason for phase one, you're going to see lots of Higgs bosons with detail, unprecedented detail, amazing detail that we've never seen and we can never see really with the LHC. This could reveal Higgs decaying into hidden particles like dark matter particles. So that would be an amazing discovery. One of the things we've been looking for so long now. We still have no idea what dark matter is. If we can get that from this device, and that'd be just phase one. Phase two is even maybe a little bit more interesting. But we're talking 2050 and another 15 billion euros to get phase two up and going. So, and this would involve the construction of much more powerful proton colliders. These are the collisions that are going to produce energies on an order of magnitude beyond the LHC. We're talking 100 TeV. That's 100 trillion electron volts. That is an amazing amount of energy. Now, with that much energy at your fingertips, this should be able to create many new particles well past what the LHC can do. It should be able to, according to theory, it should be able to create most any type of dark matter particle that's theorized. They would all exist within this energy regime of around 100 trillion electron volts. And also, this phase two could also provide a window into the universe a trillionth of a second after its birth, when the Higgs field collapses and all the particles got handed their mass cards. That time frame, a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, very important. Now, that's just the stuff that we have a decent probability of discovering. Unexpected or surprising discoveries like new dimensions or Jay's old porn magazines could still happen, and we would just have no idea.
So they're not taking them from me, are they?
So the question is it worth it? And this is a lot of money. Should we actually even do this? And my go-to response for something like that is that there's so many benefits from something like this. It's not just information that you're going to put in a book and like, oh, isn't this cool? Look what we discovered. The LHC is credited with advances in radio technology, robotics, computer science, cryogenics, et cetera, et cetera. Then you've got things like the World Wide Web, which was invented by who? Tim Berners-Lee. I won't embarrass you. Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web. And where was he working in the late 80s? He was working at CERN. And of course, right. And then one of my favorite examples is the lowly electron. When that was discovered, it was seen more like a minor oddity, more that than a game changer. And the impact of the electron should need no hype, but I'm going to hype it anyway. Electrons basically add $3 trillion to the world economy right there.
Wait, when were they first discovered? I mean, did people already know how electricity flowed, or
this was when it was first discovered. They really had no idea much about it. And there's a famous toast that some scientist gave. The toast went something like, to the lowly electron, may it never amount to anything, or something like that. So yeah, they clearly had no idea at the very beginnings of the discovery of electrons and electricity, what the impact would be on the economy. $3 trillion to the world economy a year. Amazing.
Cool. Now, Bob, let me ask you a question. What would you rather have?
AI.
This super collider.
Yes.
Or the ability to scan and map a human brain at tiny detail, high resolution and fidelity.
Define high resolution fidelity.
Down to the synaptic level.
I think this is a segue.
All right. I'll yield to your segue, Steve.
I rode on one of those amazing ones. I fell off. Oh.
Both would be amazing. I think we'll have that resolution much quicker than we would ever have a 100-kilometer accelerator.
Which would you rather have? That's the question. I know. It's a Sophie's choice.
Does not compute. Norman, please coordinate.
So we're not there either with the mapping, but we did make a step forward in our ability to create a three-dimensional maps of the synapses, the neurons, the connections, the dendrites of brain tissue. So researchers have published a study where it's very interesting. It was published in Science. They combined several techniques, actually. They focus on two techniques in particular that they combined, but they're also using fluorescence microscopy. So that's technically a third technique that they're using. So fluorescence microscopy is, as it sounds, you tag something of interest with a fluorescent protein, and then it will fluoresce when you shine light of a certain frequency on it. Then they combine that with another technique called lattice light sheet microscopy, where you shine these thin sheets of specific frequency light onto what you're trying to image. The good thing about this is that what you're not interested in, and or what will be out of focus, will be dark, and only the in focus part of what the microscope is focusing on will be illuminated. So it gives you a good sharp image, right? Because anything out of focus is not going to be illuminated in any case. But here's the new bit. They combined the lattice light sheet microscopy with a newer technique called expansion microscopy. With this, they inject brain tissue. So they did this to an entire Drosophila brain, a fly brain, but also a section of a mouse brain, one like cortical section. You inject this expanding gel, and the gel, it will increase the size of the specimen 4 to 5 times. So all of the spaces between the neurons are increased, but the relationship should be preserved. Oof. That's the goal.
But I'm sure life isn't preserved.
Though this is in, this is obviously in specimens, not in living creatures. Right, this is like a brain. So they had to actually partner with multiple people. They needed specialists who could provide for them good fly brain samples, Drosophila brain samples. They needed the expansion microscopists, the light sheet microscopists, and then they needed to partner with computer scientists who were able to take the massive amount of data that this all generated and reconstruct it into an actual three-dimensional image. But they were able to do that, combine all of this various expertise, and create a complete scan of a Drosophila brain and of a section of a mouse cortex. And they were able to do it in a few days, whereas previously this kind of detail would have taken about a year to produce. So that's a big increase. However, you know, before you get too excited, doing an entire human brain using at that rate would still take like thousands of years. So we're still a long way from scanning it. Yeah, we're not at the point where we could scan an entire human brain with this technique. It would need to be improved by orders of magnitude in terms of time. But we are getting there. When you think about it, what we're ultimately interested in, of course, is the ability to map the networks and circuits in a brain so that we can understand how they work. Starting with smaller, simpler brains like fly brains is a great way to start. We could have a better chance of not only mapping it, but then the next step then, Bob, right, is going to be to make a virtual model of it in a computer.
Yes.
And then once you do that, there's no reason to think that and what research has been done so far is that a virtual map of circuits is a circuit, right? I mean, it functions as the circuit that it's mapping. It's just a virtual circuit. So if you made a virtual human brain in a computer that could operate, you know, fast enough, it would be a human, right? It would be a consciousness, just virtually.
Yeah, to me, that's one of the most viable options for bootstrapping or AI. You know, you don't have to know the brain at a level that we are far away from ever doing that. You just take the image and instantiate it virtually, and that's it. You have it. Have an artificial intelligence in the brain, and then just go from there.
Yeah, you could use a template approach rather than trying to design it from the top down. So anyway, this is a pretty significant advance. It doesn't get us to the point where we're completely scanning somebody's brain, this is great for research, right?
At this point,
this you could produce these beautiful images of the, you know, fluorescent networks in the brain, and this will help us develop the connectome, right? The goal here is to have a complete map of all the connections in the brain.
Right. Or if you're an expert in the hippocampus, then you just focus in on the hippocampus. You know, you can probably map that whole thing or important parts of it relatively quickly, and you'll be happy as a clam.
So this is just, you know, continuing the acceleration of our ability to advance neuroscience, our understanding of the nervous system. And this is, I think, a significant milestone. But it's also, you know, obviously we have to take it to the next level from a thought experiment point of view. One thing that's interesting to think about is, like, using techniques like this, we could make a model of, for example, a human brain, right? Once we get the ability to map it at this level. But what would it take? What would it take to not create a model of a human brain, but a model of Bob Novella's brain?
Oh,
right. Ooh. So, what's the difference? What level of information is necessary for it to be you, not just a generic human? Oh. And then there's one layer beyond that, because what would it take to not only be Bob Novella's brain, but to be Bob Novella's brain in a certain state,
constantly in flux.
Yeah. So, like, that's the transporter question, right? So how does the transporter recreate not just a generic version of you, but you with all of your memories and experiences right up to the moment that you were transported? You know, that's...
Dilithium crystals, let's see, tachyons, what other technobabble is there?
The wrong technobabble. You got the wrong technobabble, Evan. The technobabble is Heisenberg compensators.
Of course.
Seriously, they talk about Heisenberg compensators because you could imagine that the Heisenberg uncertainty principle would limit our ability to reproduce a brain at the quantum level with enough fidelity to reproduce somebody's instantaneous mental state.
So I just come up with a compensator to fix that.
That's the science fiction solution, but it probably is a science solution. It may be impossible to do that.
Yeah, but doesn't that assume that quantum effects are important for consciousness? And
that's a big assumption.
Well, actually, I don't think, Steve, you would know this. I don't think neurologists right now think that the quantum world makes much of a difference for consciousness. It's more of a macroscopic phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, the quantum effects bubble up to the quantum level, but it's a matter of interpretation of how do you interpret that fact,
right?
You know? And that's hard to understand, you know what I'm saying, but that's
what
the debate is.
But are you talking about modeling something that we could, quote unquote, image or test in real time, like modeling a past state? Because that's very different than modeling a future state.
So it's more just like if I wanted to make Max Headroom, you know what I mean? You remember that TV show? Probably not.
Probably not.
But Max Headroom is a virtual copy of a living person's brain, and it
well, that's a big ask. I don't even think that's possible.
But that's what we're talking about. That's what we're talking about.
But to make a copy, a virtual copy of it at some point in time.
But even like, then, like with all your memories, how are all of your memories represented in your brain? So it's one thing to say this brain functions like your brain, this similar personality and things like that. But to say that, you know, to record all of your memories, that is a state, right? If you could get all those memories up to the current moment, it would, in a sense, reproduce your current state.
Yeah, and that's just basically modeling down to whatever the level of fidelity we need.
What
is,
level? That's the question. What's the level? At what level do you need to get to before you are actually capturing somebody's memories? And it, you know, their autobiographical memory.
But there's also, you know, I mean, this is a more philosophical question about emergent properties of the brain that it may just not be possible. Like it may absolutely not be. To have a physical imprint may not give you any emergent properties. It may be that it has to be functional in time. And that's a totally different question than like 3D printing something or making a copy of something.
I think if we get anywhere between a generic human and a human with certain personality traits or abilities that are similar to a person that we're modeling, that's pretty damn good.
Yeah, but I think that person will always be like fully uncanny valley. Like they'll be like all sorts of dysfunctional.
Yeah, it wouldn't be that person. It would be that's actually a bizarro person. It's similar that Max Headroom was that way. Max Headroom was a bizarro version of the person they were modeled after.
It was bizarro world.
It was a funny show. All right. Anyway, interesting. I'm sure this won't be the last time we talk about this topic, but it Max was an interesting milestone. All right, Kara. You always send me a bunch of items each week to choose from, and I chose this one for you to talk about because it's just different. I don't think we've ever talked about anything like this before.
No, and I mean, it's a cool article that was published in The Conversation. I highly recommend The Conversation if you guys don't read articles there because they're written by scientists. So this was written by somebody named Bridget Baker, who's a clinical veterinarian and the deputy director of the Warrior Aquatic Translational and Environmental Research at Wayne State University. And so she wrote an article called "Is Winter Miserable for Wildlife?" I think somewhere deep down, this was interesting to you, Steve, because you're living in a winter wonderland right now.
Yeah, I'm looking at this picture of a frost-covered squirrel.
Honestly, my wife and I debate about how long we could leave our dog out. And I'm like, he's got fur. Leave him out there. He's fine.
The funny thing is she doesn't even talk about fur in this article. It's like so much deeper than that. But it is interesting, right? What is so different about quote-unquote humans versus these other mammals? A lot of the animals that have been researched when it comes to cold tolerance, or I should say the vertebrates and especially the mammals that have been researched, are mice and rats. So we get a lot of our information from mice and rats. But this author also talks about birds and ectotherms and, you know, organisms that we think of as being kind of screwed when it gets really cold outside, but they have all these really cool adaptive abilities. So what we often don't realize is that animals in quote unquote the wild, animals in nature who are subject to extreme cold, can get frostbite. They can also get hypothermia. Of course, they have all these cool adaptive skills to avoid that. But if a place becomes unseasonably cold, like we're seeing sometimes with these polar vortices and these other intense winter storms, animals are also at risk. So do keep that in mind. Also, Steve, do you put your dogs in sweaters?
No.
You don't?
Yeah, no, we don't.
This is not mentioned in the article, but I do know, not from personal experience because I live in LA where we don't see the white things falling out of the sky, but from a lot of friends who live in New York, that they do have to put shoes on their dogs, and it's usually not because of the cold on their paws, but it's because of the salt. So salt can actually be really dangerous for your dog's paws to walk around on, and of course they use
salt. Because they'll lick it off when they get back inside. They'll sit down and lick the salt off, and there's usually other chemicals in there.
That's not safe, but I think it also is topically not healthy for them. They tend to like blister and crack and stuff when they come into contact with the salt. So
makes sense too.
Yeah, that's why a lot of people put little shoes on their dogs.
I've seen it.
Yeah, apparently She writes opossums because this is a very regional thing, but in the South, we still call them possums.
The O is silent.
Yeah, you guys say possums, but there's an O at the beginning, which is so weird to me. But possum tails are really susceptible to cold. Again, Steve, you mentioned fur. I think she just glosses over fur being good for the cold because we all kind of already know that fur is good for the cold.
Yeah, but. I mean, there's more to it than that. And I did some digging in this as well beyond that article. So,
into the fur thing.
Yeah, just the cold adaptation. And you know, fur obviously is huge because it traps the air, which is insulating layer. But also birds' feathers are really good insulation. Mm-hmm. So like, for example, the emperor penguin, which may be the most cold-adapted animal on the planet, they have four layers of overlapping scale-like feathers. So that gives them protection from the wind in addition to the cold. And then they showed a picture of like an Arctic fox, like really, really fluffy.
Fluffy, yeah. And that's the thing.
It captures more air.
Steve, yeah, they're wearing their own clothes. I mean, that's the biggest difference. But Steve, there's a lot of stuff. Go ahead.
Steve, you would think that they're more cold adapted than even sea mammals?
They breed at the bottom of the world, right? They go actually to like the coldest spot on the world to breed because they do that to get away from their predators. So I don't know, but it's hard to compare that to being under
like
water.
A narwhal.
Yeah, because water conducts heat much better than the air, and so animals who are swimming in icy water, maybe they have to be the most cold adapted. That's a good point.
Yeah.
They're also different. You know, they're different organisms. Like the birds have to go into the water and also have to stand on ice for long periods of time. And so there's a whole system of heat exchange that a lot of birds have evolved on their feet in order to keep their feet from getting frostbite, because otherwise that would be the first thing to go, is these little feet that stand on ice for long periods of time. But I did mention, you know, sometimes these natural evolutionary tricks just aren't good enough. And so there's, you know, news articles of manatees dying when it got unseasonably cold in Florida. There's articles of iguanas literally falling out of trees during some Florida cold snaps. They didn't, they probably weren't dead. They were just in torpor. But that was a thing. Like iguanas were literally falling out of trees. So you can see all these like hilarious and sad photos on the internet. So you think about extremities, right? Think about human beings and what starts to go if we get stuck out in the cold. First thing is frostbite.
Yeah, ears and fingers and
ears, fingers, toes. And toes.
Extremities.
And the tips of your noses, yeah. And so Steve mentioned a side-by-side picture of an Arctic fox and a fennec fox. You guys have all seen fennec foxes, right? If you haven't, Google it right now. I don't care if you're driving.
My friend owned one.
Really.
with the ears.
Oh, don't say that out loud, Bob. That's horrible.
Why?
Because they are not like the fennec fox pet trade. Bad, 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 bad.
Oh.
Like they're not pets. But Google these pictures. They're literally some of the cutest animals on the planet. And yeah, when you look at the difference between an Arctic fox and a fennec fox, Arctic fox's ears are almost non-existent. They're teeny tiny and really close to the head.
Yeah,
and fennec fox's
heat.
Ears are huge.
Yeah, because they need to radiate the heat. Like think of an elephant's ears. It's a radiator.
So you look at these organisms that are really, really cold adaptive, and they have a lot of features in common. They have an interesting heat exchange mechanism in their feet oftentimes. They actually just don't have long appendages. Lots of times they're stumpy, they're wide, and they're very close to the body. And that helps to protect against things like frostbite, because you know, animals can have frostbite. And of course, one thing that we've all heard about is organisms that hibernate. A lot of organisms that live in winter, harsh winter environments will hibernate. But there's also this in-between area called torpor, which I mentioned with the with the iguanas. And that's just slowing down and actually literally lowering the core body temperature. So this is an endothermic trait. You know, these are warm-blooded animals who are tasked with regulating their own body temperature regardless of what it feels like outside. And they'll do things like just slow down. They actually call this a heterotherm. Ooh. It's sort of like an in-between of being endothermic and ectothermic, that they'll lower their core body temperature and they'll get really, really slow. But this is obviously an evolutionary trade-off, because when you can't really move, you also get eaten pretty easily. And this happens with a lot of birds that will go into torpor, because they can't fly when they're in torpor at all. They're just not capable of doing it. So that's pretty dangerous. You know, one of the big takeaways of this article was about how animals start to do the things, the actual biological processes that they do in order to stave off the cold or in order to protect themselves from the cold. And a lot of that has to do with the inputs. So cold is a sensation, right? It's a touch sensation. So we have neurons that can actually tell us if it feels cold outside, cold to the touch, that tingly, you know, burny sensation. And different animals, the ion channels open, that relays the signal, open at different temperatures. So a lot of these cold weather organisms, they don't feel cold until it's colder than when we feel cold. And these things can actually be upregulated. Like, we can adapt to some extent, which is why people who live in
Alaska.
Yeah, Alaska, even other northern, you know, super cold northern states in the lower 48 can walk around outside in a t-shirt when it's 60 degrees. And I live in LA and I'm freezing at 60 degrees. Like, I wear a hoodie when it's 70, you know, and that's because we're adapted to the places where we live and to the variations in the temperature to an extent. We can't adapt the way that many of these animals can, because, you know, we would probably die if we tried to survive an Arctic winter the way that a fox does. Also, there's some cool stuff that I learned about with some fish. Some fish may not have the receptor that senses cold at all.
Whoa.
That's kind of weird. Mm. And they also have antifreeze proteins inside of...
blood?
Well, they produce antifreeze proteins, yeah, that help to bind to ice crystals in their blood, which is really neat. You know, other than fur, one of the most obvious ways that we protect against cold is the same thing that happens to all of us when we walk outside in the cold. What's that?
Build a fire.
Well, okay.
No, we shiver.
What's even more basic? Yeah, we shiver, right? We shiver, our teeth chatter, all those things. And that actually makes, it's just our muscles contracting and firing and it really, really quickly. And that builds up heat. The assumption I would think that is that it's somewhat uncomfortable because animals need to be able to do what they do in order to avoid the cold, or in order, like, especially organisms for whom the temperature threshold is a little bit higher. So I'm not talking about an Arctic fox or even like a penguin who doesn't really have many places to go, but an animal that might burrow during winter. I guess the assumption is that the cold starts to feel kind of crappy and they decide to start to burrow because the cold feels crappy.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't really know. We don't know what their subjective experience is like. And, you know, that's something that's always fascinated me about animals for whom we have so much conserved DNA. How similar to us are they?
It's funny you should say that. Just yesterday, my mom was saying, it was 8 degrees Fahrenheit out. And she's like, how do these little birds, what do they do? How do they survive? Why aren't they just a solid ice bird and just like fall to the ground?
Well, but you notice though that the birds in the winter will fluff themselves up incredibly. Like, they puff themselves up, and that's really very effective insulation.
And also, I mean, Steve, it would be interesting, you know, you birdwatch a lot from your balcony, right?
Yeah,
like, not, you don't just go out in places, but you bird. So you probably have such a good understanding of the environment around your house that you can see things that you might not have been able to see when you first started birdwatching there. And I'd be interested to see if there are birds in trees in torpor around your house right now that aren't flying. They just seem to not be doing anything on these little branches in their trees.
Yeah, you don't see them. Because birds are
very good at hiding.
They're very good at hiding. Yeah, you only usually see birds when they move.
Yep.
Especially unless there's a big bird, like a hawk. Yeah, obviously. But like little birds, like songbirds, if they're not at my feeder,
yeah,
I usually will only see them when they like fly from one branch to another branch. So if they're like hunkered down, forget about it. You're not going to see them.
Yeah. And the birds that tend to gain up this body mass and fat in order to like boost their metabolism and then to use what this one researcher was calling facultative hypothermia, which is where they actually downregulate their core body temperature to reduce that heat loss and to save energy. Like, they'll go from 42 degrees down to 35 degrees Celsius at their core body temperature, but also they can't fly when they're doing this. These are tiny birds like titmice and chickadees. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. But, you know, even on the when it's as cold as it gets here, I still see them at my feeder. They, you know, some of them are still active.
Well, yeah, they got to eat, right, to maintain all of that metabolic processing. That's
but I wonder, really but here's something that's interesting. I wonder if we're changing their behavior by saying, here's a whole bunch of calories.
Oh, you probably.
Know, so maybe they can stay more active.
Yeah, exactly. Because that is the interesting thing, right? It's sort of a catch-22 for a lot of these organisms that they need to have their metabolism. Oftentimes they'll cool down in order to conserve some of that energy they would need for their metabolism. But also during the winter is when food is least available.
February is the most important month. So if you do keep a bird feeder, the impact that you have is greatest at least in this part of the country, in February. You actually can affect, there's studies would show you it affects like how many eggs they'll lay in the spring. You know, is affected by whether they got fed in February or not.
Yeah, so like when you say the impact, you mean literally for survival.
More birds survive. They are healthier at the end of the winter. They will have more chicks, you know, when they breed. It makes a big difference. Yeah, we fill our bird feeder. That's a ton of calories, you know, compared to like what's out there in the middle of February, you know.
And
we also put out the suet, which is just pure fat, and like the bigger birds, like the woodpeckers, love it. And that's really calorie dense.
Yeah, if you die, those birds are going to die too.
No, it's true. If I stop feeding them, there would be a massive die off.
You have to almost like put it in your will, you know.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Last week I played this noisy.
0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
What is that?
A speak and spell?
The horse says.
E.T.
So James Ezekiel wrote in and said, I think the noisy from episode 706 is the SP0256 narrator speech synthesizer chip that was included in Mattel's IntelliVoice voice synthesis module for the Intellivision. Now, I don't think a lot of people will remember that. I do remember that.
I remember Intellivision.
Yes. And it does sound quite similar. It's not it, but it is a very good guess because there is a similar sound there. It definitely has the, you know, like a robotic electronic type of voice, but that is not correct. Paul Tate said, hey there, you guys, having watched a lot of Bruce Perry tribes, I'm pretty certain that this week's noisy is a member of the Kambai tribe saying farewell to someone and has a melancholy tone to it. If it isn't the correct answer, Google the Kambai farewell whistle. Much love. So that's spelled K-O-M-B-A-I. Not correct. You know, the thing about that is I think it's very clear that we're hearing numbers in there. So it would have been a hell of a coincidence if them saying goodbye is like someone counting from 1 to 10. You know, I didn't hear what their goodbye is. It could be similar to that. So I have another guest here. This one's coming from Ashley Spahala, which I would have pronounced Spychala, but she told me how to pronounce it. So there you go.
Yay.
She said, hey guys, love you all and what you do. Been listening for about 8 or so years and have only submitted an answer one other time, which I won, which was the Audubon bird clock. So hopefully I'm not killing my undeniably perfect record here. I'm bursting that this is a recording of Stephen Hawking configuring his first visual speech module.
Whoa. Oh.
And oddly, many people guessed that. A lot of people wrote in and guessed that one. That's not correct.
Oh, sorry, Ashley. Oh.
Yeah, sorry. But you're 50-50. You're doing better than Steve is with science or fiction.
That's true.
But we did have a winner last week. And the winner is Brian Landry. And Brian said, hey, Jay, it's rare that I actually know the noisy of the week, so I figured I'd write it down. I believe that this noisy is the result of a computer interpreting and reading the thoughts of someone's brainwaves. So, yes, indeed, this is. So this technology has been researched for quite a while by multiple different teams. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to – their ultimate goal will be that if somebody thinks of – a sentence that a computer could say it. Now, this would be particularly good for people who can't speak, that are you know, suffering from a disease or multiple things that could be going wrong with someone where they can't move or gesture. They can't do the Holy Grail yet. They can't just have the person think of it. But what they're able to do at this level is the person could be hearing the sounds of someone speaking. And the computer and the software that they have, and they have electrodes that are hooked up to the exposed brain, and they can interpret what the person is hearing into that sound. So let me play that again now that you know what it is.
0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Now this is a little creepy. They can only do this experiment on people who have their brain exposed for one medical reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few different scenarios where they would have to expose a part of the brain. It could be for surgery. It could be treating someone that has a certain condition. So this is, you know, they can't do this research on just anybody. It has to be under these certain conditions.
Yeah, but, Jay, just to be clear, that doesn't mean their brain is, you know, exposed to the outside in an ongoing manner. It just means that they have brain surface electrodes placed.
Well, Steve, it's likely because this is still in, like, early research. So it may actually be only tested during neurosurgery.
It could intraoperatively.
Exactly.
Fine.
But with deep – there's plenty of, like, deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's, for example. Yeah, there's an electrode that's placed into the brain, and then the skull is closed again.
I don't think that they leave this in there permanently. They were just doing testing. So what we're looking at is a picture of the top of somebody's head, and the bone has been taken off, like the crown of the head has been taken off, and there's a number chart. It looks like just a sheet of plastic that they've put over the person's head that has a bunch of electrodes touching the brain in all different places. What they're doing is they're reading the brain as the person is hearing sound, and they're able to single out what the brain is doing when it's hearing particular types of input.
Yeah, and this wouldn't be the top of the head. That's like the left side. You just can't see that.
Oh, you're right. I mean...
It wouldn't make any sense if it was on the top of the head.
You've got to be right, Carrie. You're right. It's not just the top because you're not seeing two hemispheres. You're only seeing
part and your of speech region. And this is for understanding speech.
Right.
Right? Yeah. So it would be in that part of the brain.
Now, I find this completely fascinating because... they are actually, in one way or another, they're working on a brain-to-computer interface. You know, because think about it. If you can think words, you know, then a computer will be able to – once the interpretation has been done for the computer to understand that it sounds like one, which we already can do. We already have voice recognition. You could actually think to a computer and have something happen then at that point. So this is really important research and very interesting. And
yeah, but we're not there yet. Just again, to be clear, there are only – they're only distinguishing among a limited set of possible targets.
Yeah.
This is not open. It's not like, just think of a word and the computer tells what the word
is. There's also kind of no reason to think that we won't be able to get there.
Well, I don't know. Well, that's not really? Necessarily just incremental. I don't know. I wouldn't assume that.
I just think that we are so good at mapping, at this point, at mapping motor speech areas.
We might not get there as an extrapolation of what we're currently doing, and it may require more than brain surface electrodes to get there.
Yeah, I think it'll be more than on the surface.
Yeah, but that's what we're looking at now. This is like intraoperative brain surface electrodes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they'll be deep, but I don't think that like we're going – you know, the fact that we are capable with motor areas – of thinking, having an electrode in a certain region, and we've done this with monkeys, but we've done it with humans as well, thinking about how to move your arm and being able to move your arm, that's a motor area. Speech is similar, it's just much more complicated.
It's deceptive to say that it's similar because the motor strip displays somatotopic mapping, mm-hmm. which means that you could actually draw the body on the, you know, it's the homunculus, right?
Like yeah,
the
body. So we know where the arm is. We know where the hand is. That's true.
The same is not true for the language area.
No, but we know where they are. It's
but we don't know where a word is. We don't know where a word in the brain is. That's what I'm saying. It's not, it's like orders of magnitude more complicated than the motor strip.
But words aren't somatotopically in the brain.
They're not. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, so, I thought you said we don't know where they are. They aren't there. Like,
oh, I know. That's what I'm saying. It's
a point-to-point correlation.
There isn't. That's the point. It's got it. Well, it has to be somewhere. Like the word hurricane has to be encoded somewhere in your brain. But it's not like I can say where it is because it's the word hurricane.
But the word hurricane is encoded in the exact same place that any other word is encoded. The emergent property of making words, but that happens in Broca.
No, but there has to be a network of neurons that – or light up when I use that word versus a different word.
Yeah, but they're all in the same place is what I'm saying.
So they're in the same region, yes, yeah. but there's got to be within that region, there's a lot of information that's being stored.
Sure. It's the same as like a motor region saying move the hand to the left or move it to the right or move it up or squeeze it tighter or squeeze it less tight, which we're getting there with.
But I'm saying is there's every reason to think that it's orders of magnitude more complicated.
More complicated. Yeah, completely agree. But the cool thing is that at least from the example of like understanding motor speech, we know a lot.
Yeah.
And so I see this being able to happen. I do. I just don't know if it's going to happen, you know, terribly soon. But the ability, like the amount of time that it's taken for us to get to motor control of limbs, of artificial limbs, has been astonishing. It's happened in my lifetime.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible.
It's true. I just want to emphasize that because I do think that these get overhyped when these kind of machine brain interface. I mean, and I hype them too, but I don't overhype them. I think this is going to be an incredible technology.
You hype them just perfectly.
I know, I do. I hit the sweet spot. I think in the 21st century, brain machine interface is going to be a huge technology.
Yeah.
But we are picking the low hanging fruit with the visual cortex and the motor cortex. And we simply don't know how much more difficult it's going to be to do the higher cognitive areas of the brain.
And
it's like, it could be like the jetpack where it's like, it's going to be 20 years away for the next 100 years because it's going to be really difficult to get there. All we know is that it's going to be a lot more difficult. We don't know how much more difficult it's going to be.
But I think this is
maybe easier than we think,
plausible.
But it may be a lot. It's totally plausible. There's no reason why we won't
get
there
eventually.
It's
more plausible than like colonies on Mars. Let's put it that way.
No,
like,
I think it's about the same. No, I think it's about the same. Kara, I wouldn't take that bet.
It always comes back to that, doesn't it?
I would not bet that we're going to accomplish what you're saying faster than we'll get a colony on Mars. I think those are equally far off.
And I would.
All right.
All right. Last time I bring up something about the brain. Here is the new noisy. This one was sent in by Justice Smith, and I hope you like it. So if you think you know what the noisy is for this week, or if you heard something cool, something that would be good for Who's That Noisy, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Evan, you're going to give us a dumbest thing of the week.
Neat.
The dumbest thing of the week came to us courtesy of a listener, Paul Roberts. Thank you, Paul. I appreciate this. He sent us the news article that the Supreme Court building in Adelaide, Australia is allegedly haunted. And how do we know this? Because a medium said so. Well, you see, this medium is in contact with the former Supreme Court Chief Justice of Australia, Sir George Murray, who died about 80 years ago. And according to the unnamed medium, the spirit of Sir George Murray has expressed his concern with plans to redevelop the Adelaide courtroom where he had spent over a quarter of a century working. Now, the court building is undergoing a $31 million set of renovations and redesigns. But concerns for the judge expressed by the medium is telling officials that there are problems and George Murray is not impressed with the plans. So this woman was hired by Hansen Yunkin, a firm that is handling...
The ones who are actually trying to do the renovation hired a medium so that she could tell them to not do the renovation?
That's
basically.
Right. Yeah, that's
basically... Why would they do that? Or why would they, like... Why, well, after she said that, would they go public
It's not that they don't want them to do the renovations. It's that... The spirit of this Supreme Court justice has concerns and would like them incorporated.
I'm sure
suggested
that's going to be a lot more expensive than if they just never hired the medium.
At a certain point, you wonder if you're at The Onion or some other parody site reading this. But no, this is actually happening. Even though the firm, they're saying, oh, we hired this medium to come do this, please. That is going to get passed on to the taxpayers like the rest of their bill. And so... the people of Australia, you're the ones who are actually paying for this medium to come in and speak and allegedly speak with ghosts and other things. And of course, it has, you know, nobody in government seems to be throwing up any issues or having any problems with this.
They will once the redesign costs more money. Well, then they'll be like, oh, we probably shouldn't have hired that medium. She's a quack.
Apparently, they've not made any final decisions about actually implementing any changes to the plans at this point. But apparently they have, you know, made sure they want to be inclusive of dead people's opinions as opposed to be exclusive and take them into consideration. My guess is that they're not going to change a damn thing. And this thing was just an exercise to entertain someone at this construction firm or design firm who has something, some sort of interest in the paranormal. Who knows? But just remarkable that our governments actually, yes, they do. They pay for these things, which means you pay for these things. And there's no one there on the opposite side to sort of say, hey, what is this and why are we promoting the paranormal and pseudoscience and absolute garbage? So that, my friends, is the dumbest thing of the week. Now, aside from that, a little footnote here. I noticed, I looked at a map of Adelaide, Australia, and it's a coastal city, or pretty much on the coast there. Off the coast is an island called Kangaroo Island. And it makes you wonder what kind of quartz they have on Kangaroo Island, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So I just thought I'd throw that out there. Thank you.
They should be fired. I don't know what else to say.
I mean,
using
seriously.
Using tax dollars for this? It's like...
Or
it's
just
disgusting.
You're incompetent. I'm sorry, you hired a medium and you're listening to their advice on how to, you're fired. You don't even get through the sentence, you're done. It's crazy. All right.
All right. Dumbest thing of the week, folks.
All right. Thanks, Evan. All right. Let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. No theme this week, just three news items. Are you ready?
Yep.
Yes.
All right, Here we go. Item number one, researchers have developed a laser that can deliver conversational sounds at distance to a recipient's ear without any receiving device. Item number two, a new analysis concludes that most of Earth's life-forming elements likely came from the collision with a Mars-sized planet that formed the Moon. And item number three, a new study of all major bird groups finds little to no correlation between the shape of the bird's beak and their feeding behavior. Kara, go first.
Researchers have developed a laser that can... I don't even understand this one. A laser that can deliver conversational sounds.
Meaning they're audible, like they're in the conversation, how loud they are. They're conversationally loud
enough. I thought lasers just encoded light. How do they deliver audio? I'm so confused by this one. At a distance to a recipient's ear without any receiving device. So you're saying like a person says something... Like, they shoot lasers out of their mouth and somebody else hears it? I'm so confused. I like how everybody else is dead silent because they're like, she's dumb. We totally understand this one. And I'm so confused. Like, do I not know what a laser is all of a sudden? Ugh. A new analysis concludes that most of Earth's life-forming elements likely came from the collision with a Mars-sized planet that formed the Moon. Okay, well... I'm pretty sure that there was supposed to be a collision with Earth that formed the Moon. I feel like this was a science or fiction like last year. So maybe the life-forming elements would have come from that. Because we're not talking about like proteins or we're not talking about how they form together.
Nitrogen, sulfur, carbon.
Yeah, the basic
carbon,
elements.
Yeah,
carbon,
the basic elements,
like yeah, I mean, those would have a celestial or a, you know, whatever, an origin somewhere from a sun that would ultimately have been in another planet. So I don't know. That one doesn't seem that weird to me. A new study of all major bird groups. You love your birds. I know nothing about birds. They find little to no correlation between the shape of the bird's beak and their feeding behavior. But isn't this like Darwin's whole thing with the finches? Isn't it like really, right? Am I wrong here, you guys? Like all the finches were like eating different seeds and crap?
That's correct.
That's the whole point. There's nothing tricky in the term feeding behavior here, right? Like you're talking about what they eat and how they eat
it. Yeah, Yeah.
Okay. All right. I don't know. It's probably going to be number three, the bird one, which is, you know, tricky. But I have to say it's the weird laser one because I don't understand a laser delivering audio waves. Like, I just don't get it. I thought that lasers were only light. Light emitting something.
Light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation.
Thank you. Oh, shoot. But there's other radiations. No, it's light. It's light. I don't like this one. I'm going to say the laser one is a fiction. And if it's science, then whatever.
Okay. Bob?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard, I'm having a little bit of problem with the laser one as well. I mean, I've heard of ultrasonics that can be tuned. It's called audio spotlights. So that at a distance, basically the ultrasonic wave interferes in such a way that it creates an audible like wake to it that can then be manipulated by the ultrasonics to produce a sound that you could understand. Cause ultrasonics, you can't hear. But the wake, the audible wake, you can hear. But using a laser, now could a laser be used for a similar idea without the ultrasonic component? Or maybe you're not giving us the full picture here, and it's a laser plus something else. Can the laser interfere? Can the frequency interfere in such a way that it creates, you know, the compressions and rarefactions of the air that you could hear? Damn, that's an interesting one to think about. Let's look at some of these other ones. Most of Earth's life-forming elements came from the Mars-sized planet that hit the moon. I'm not buying that. You know, what just so happened that the important elements came from this Mars-sized planet? How would you even know that? What came from what? I'm having trouble with that one, obviously. Let's look at this third one. Yeah, the beak bird thing. Yeah, I'm okay. I'm kind of okay with that one. The other two, I have more of a problem with. So, which one should I pick? All right, lasers can do anything. I'm just gonna assume that they're just so. Come on, they're just so damn versatile. I'm not sure exactly how the mechanism would work, but I've got more of a problem with this Mars-sized planet that just so happened because of that. So, I'm gonna say that the Earth one is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
All right, so to take this first one here, I think what Steve is saying is that there's no receiving device. Which means, I think what he's saying is there's no electronic receiving device. And maybe the receiving device is actually the person's head. I'm serious. It could be vibrating.
That is
skull.
What he's saying.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Take so I think that one is science. The second one is, that one is like, wow, how do we even know that? Really? Like the Mars-sized planet that formed the moon, that hit the Earth, that's where those elements came from? I mean, again, all right. Okay. I don't know. That's a really hard one to sink my teeth into. I got to tell you, though, I think the third one here about the birds' beaks is the fiction, because I've seen birds use their specialized beaks for different types of feeding. So I think that one is the fiction.
All right. So you guys are all split. So, Evan.
Ah, I hate the role of tiebreaker, or however you want to define this, because I think all three are fiction. That's my starting position. So, wow, I'm in the dark here. I think we know lasers can deliver audio, that's not new in itself. I think Jay hit on the point that without any receiving device, that I think is the key to this one. But how exactly does that work? You just, if it stops at a wall or something, you stand at the wall and that's where you have to go to hear what's going on, I suppose. You know, just put yourself close to the wall. So that's interesting, but not impossible. So that's plausible. The Earth's life-forming elements likely came from the collision. Bob brought up the great point. How do you know that? How do you know those elements weren't already there when the collision happened? I believe the collision.
I think Jay said that.
Oh, did Jay say it? I could have sworn Bob said that.
Yeah, I could have sworn I said it too.
Well, we
I
both
think
said
Jay
it.
Said it too. Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
Well, gotcha. Bob said it first, so he gets
gotcha.
The credit
yeah,
there.
Right.
So that's Thank the you. Problem with that one. And then the major bird groups, I'll go with what Kara said. And yeah, I mean, Darwin's finches is like the example that sticks out in your head and contrasts this one. So of the three, I think, since I think they're all fiction, the one that's most fictiony, I'm going to go with Bob and say Earth's life-forming elements with the collision from Mars. No, I don't think that one's going to turn out to be the science. So it has to be the fiction.
Crap. So wait, Jay, we're out on separate limbs?
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
But I will look at you as we die.
Okay, cool. Or, yeah. We'll reach across to try to hold hands.
All right. So I guess there's no reason not to take these in order. So we'll start with Researchers have developed a laser that can deliver conversational sounds at distance to a recipient's ear without any receiving device. Kara, you are alone in thinking that this one is the fiction. The guys think that this one is science, and this one is science. Sorry, Kara.
How does it transfer it and make it into sound?
Right.
It's called the photoacoustic effect.
Ooh, light sound effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so some materials can absorb, you know, light at a certain frequency and produce sound. And mm-hmm. the researchers found a way to do that with water vapor as the receiving device, actually. So they're using lasers to stimulate water vapor to vibrate and to create audible sound. So they have to use a technique called dynamic photoacoustic spectroscopy, or DPAS. That's an initialism, right, Bob?
Yes.
Yeah. I hope so. I hope it's not ass.
So they have to use like a scanning or sweeping laser beam in order to produce the sound. So this was able to produce a much louder. They were able to get the volume of the noise up to like audible levels by using the scanning or sweeping technique, but it also degrades the quality of the sound. So they still need to tweak the technique so that it produces better quality sound. But yeah, and then they could do it right now over 2.5 meters inside. So 2.5 meters, 60 decibels, which is respectable.
Yeah.
But they're hoping to get the distances longer and get the sound quality better. But
so the sound, it's not like for clandestine information transmission, right?
If they get the distance higher.
Well, wait, I mean, you said that it sweeps back and forth. So doesn't that mean that people in a specific area, all of them would hear it?
No. I mean, Bob, very, very tiny, sweeping back and forth over like the distance of one person's ear.
Okay,
so
all right.
This would target a single person. You would be able to target a single person with this. So it's like the sound is being beamed into your ear.
But through That's water? Creepy. I'm still confused about
that. Yeah, by vibrating the water in the air. Next to your ear.
In the air next to your ear. I thought a laser had to strike a puddle of water.
Humidity has to be a certain level? Or?
They said even in very dry environments, there's still enough water to do
right.
it.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting application. I mean, the audio spotlight I talked about, that's, you know, they have that now. I mean, they could basically whisper in your ear from across the store if they wanted to. It's line of sight, and it's a similar idea, but I guess a laser could potentially be more robust. I don't know, but it's cool idea.
Yeah, if they could get it to a commercial, to try and develop a commercial product out of this, if they can get it to that point, it'd be interesting. And it would be like a spy device. Like you could communicate to people from across the room. All right, let's go on to number two. A new analysis concludes that most of Earth's life-forming elements likely came from the collision with a Mars-sized planet that formed the moon. Bob and Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Jay, you are by yourself now, thinking this one is the science. And this one is...
Say it.
Science. Oh, congratulations, whoa. Jay.
Wow. Well done, right. Jay.
Go, Jay, go.
Yeah, Jay.
So how do they know? So first of all, this is based on a new analysis.
Science.
This is a computer simulation, and they ran over a billion scenarios to see likely... Yeah. So how do they know what the Earth is made of? Well, they are inferring this from mostly asteroids, right? From chondritic and other types of asteroids. They can tell the ratio of different elements in these type of asteroids. And the standard interpretation is that the inner rocky solar system is volatile depleted, right? There aren't many volatiles in the inner solar system. So where did the Earth get all its volatiles from? That's the big question. And we don't really know the answer to that. And this is that the researchers were trying to figure that out. And so there's other lines of evidence as well. It's not just the makeup of these asteroids, also the makeup of the Earth, right? What is the ratio of different alloys, elements, and different isotopes. Of those elements. And they ran multiple different scenarios, and the one that fits all the evidence the best is the idea that this Mars-sized planet, which could have formed farther out in the solar system, had a different mix of volatiles, had all of the, you know, the sulfur and nitrogen and all those compounds, which are absolutely necessary for life as we know it. We always have to throw that in, life as we know it. were actually delivered to the Earth in that collision. And were it not for that collision,
God, we wouldn't be here. Jesus.
We would be a typical inner rocky planet, very depleted of volatiles. Yeah. Huh.
Thank you, Mars-sized planet. I think they call it Theia. They call it Theia, I think.
Yeah.
It does have a name. I think Bob is right. Yeah, so this is not a done deal, obviously. This is still, you know, it's an analysis. It's not that firm, but they did over a billion simulations. This was the most viable, you know, answer that we have so far. Cool. Yeah, it's interesting.
Life is so contingent.
All this means that a new study of all major bird groups finds little to no correlation between the shape of the bird's beak and their feeding behavior is fiction, although I wonder if any of you guys read the headlines.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And of course, didn't help.
Yeah.
I had a vague memory about something about bird beaks that were counterintuitive.
Yes. So this was definitely a headline gotcha. Nah. If you read, because the articles were actually not just the headlines, but the articles themselves, I felt were misleading. All of the mainstream articles, because they're obviously just pulling it from the press release. So it's like, for example, Science Daily, which is normally a good site. Bird beaks did not adapt to food types as previously thought, right? Bird beaks did not adapt to food types. Here's the headline. The title of the article itself, Evolution of Shape and Leverage of Bird Beaks Reflects Feeding Ecology, right? It's the exact opposite.
Yeah, how did they get that so wrong?
But not as strongly as expected. So they took not as strongly as expected into it doesn't reflect it. But the first part of the sentence is it does reflect it. So it's one of those situations where they almost got the bottom line the exact opposite. They, you know what I mean? Because they were trying to do the man bites dog story. So here's the thing. And Kara is right. This goes all the way back to Darwin's finches, is this idea that bird beaks are particularly adapted to the feeding behavior of the birds. And that was, you know, one of the observations that led Darwin to initially even hypothesize
crack
about
those seeds
evolution.
Open with that beak.
Exactly. So this is the first analysis where they looked at all of the major bird groups and they tried to correlate, you know, with the computer analysis, they tried to correlate the shape of the beak and their feeding behavior. And of course, there is a strong correlation. It's just not as strong as they had previously thought. So there's still, it had lower explanatory power, right? The feeding factor. So that means, what that means is that there are non-feeding functions of the beak that also have an influence on its evolution, right? So the beaks are for more than just feeding. And also it means that beaks are kind of multi-tools, right? So they do a lot of things. They're actually meant to be a little versatile. And if they're versatile, it means they're not evolved to be optimized for just one narrow behavior.
I mean, they could swing out a blade or something from them.
A can opener.
Yeah, it's not a Swiss Army knife, but important. But they could use it for multiple things. So, of course, that also depends on the bird species. Some, you know, bird species are going to have more feeding adapted beaks than others, like woodpeckers are obviously, their beaks are highly adapted for their woodpecking, for example. And crossbills, you know, they use the crossbill to crack open those seeds, I think they use it to like hold open the cones, the pine cones, so they can get to the seed. So some very specialized feeding behavior may require some very specialized bill designs. But, you know, a lot of bird bills are pretty generic and, you know, they're kind of versatile. They're not really too specific. So that's it. You know, it was just like, oh, this is not as much explanatory as power as we thought. That means that the influence of non-feeding functions is bigger than we thought when it comes to bird beaks. But that got interpreted in the mainstream media as it's not due to feeding. But that's like the opposite of what the data shows.
Fake news.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's us. Definitely this is one where if you read just the headline, that would have caused problems for you.
You
but
live
Steve,
for that
wouldn't,
shit.
Wouldn't you, if you were asked this question before reading the headline, I think you would have known the answer like I did. Like, you know, birds' beaks are very specialized.
Yeah, so I actually, it all comes down to the wording, and I was debating with myself, you know, the two versions of this were, should I just say little correlation or no correlation or little to no correlation? Because I wanted to make sure it was strong enough without being a giveaway. So I thought that little to no was a good compromise there.
Yeah, it seemed to work.
Yeah, well, just like if I just said little correlation, that's too vague. No correlation is too absolute. It would have given it away. But little to no, I thought Kent was in the sweet spot. But anyway,
yeah,
good
whatever.
Job, Jay.
Thank you. I am very happy.
Done. Well done. Well done.
Well done. All right, Evan, you got a quote for us?
Yep. Humility before the facts is the only thing that keeps a rational man together. Hugh Laurie. Yes, ooh, Dr. Yeah. House himself.
Did he say that in yeah. character or as Hugh Laurie?
No, he said it as Hugh Laurie.
Oh, cool.
He's definitely on our side of things.
Yeah, he's definitely a skeptic.
I wonder if he felt that way or if he was as strong a skeptic before he played that character.
That's a good question.
Or if it kind of influenced him, or if he influenced the character, you know?
I mean, Dr. House is basically Sherlock Holmes. I'm sure I've mentioned that before on the show. But
yes.
So I don't know how much, you know, the character changed based upon Hugh Laurie, but
yeah.
It is interesting that, you know, it's like there are psychological studies which show that if you basically randomly assign somebody to express a certain opinion, that they actually move their own opinions towards that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You know, statistically speaking. So there's just something psychologically, like we want to be consistent. So if we, you know, if you say, all right, you are randomly assigned to defend this position in this debate, you actually go over to that position, even though you know it was just imposed upon you.
Like a debate club? Like if you're
yeah.
Yeah, that's why it's so hard to be in a debate club, because mm-hmm. you have to sometimes put yourself in a position where you're defending something that's, you know, contrary to what you actually believe.
Mm-hmm. But you can learn a lot that way, that's for sure.
That's true. Mm-hmm. That's true. So I do wonder, like, how much roles influence characters, especially one that's so long-standing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that was probably just a huge part of his identity for so long.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously this doesn't perfectly apply, but you see this all the time when two actors work for years and years and years together on a role in which they are romantically involved, they will often mm-hmm. become romantically involved in
well,
life.
That's got to be hard.
It's very common that actors playing opposite one another will become romantically involved.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
So we have an announcement, an update on our April 26th show that we're going to be doing with George Rob.
Yeah.
We have some more details on what the show is going to be, and I think it's going to be fun. So there's basically going to be four things that are happening divided into two segments, right? So there's going to be the daytime segment and the evening show. The day show is going to have from 3 to 5, we're basically going to do a private recording of the SGU. So if you get a ticket to the day show, you can attend the private recording. But from noon to around 2:30, there's going to be a role-playing lunch with the SGU and George.
Wait, I didn't agree to this. What are you talking about?
That's why it's okay. Just read your role, Bob. You'll get instructions
so,
later.
The details of what that role-playing event is haven't been determined yet, but mm-hmm. but the rough outline is there, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So don't worry if you are not an experienced role-player. This is going to be designed so that if you've never done it before and you have no idea what you're doing, it'll be just fine. And it'll be
good.
A lot of fun.
My hand is raised yep. right now.
And it will be a lot like this. It's going to be a lot of fun.
It's going to be kind of like hosting a murder party.
Yeah, more like that. Yeah.
Yeah, but don't let the name scare you. It's more of a soiree.
Yeah,
you don't have to tell people you're LARPing.
It's not a
right.
LARP.
But you can if you want to, you can. But yes, and it'll be skeptically themed, of course, but it's going to be fun. It's going to be written so that, like, if you want to be a wallflower and just enjoy the show, you could do that. If you want to participate, you could do that. It's like the whole spectrum will be accommodated, and it'll be a lot of fun. Plus, several members of the SGU are not only experienced, but professional mm-hmm. role players.
That's right. Yep.
Right? We have literally been paid for it. So yeah. Anyway.
So mark yep. your calendar, and we will put up an event where you can actually sign up. We'll do that. We'll straighten all that out with George over the next week, and we'll have that up very soon. But just, you know, if you're right. interested, just put it on your calendar for now.
And wait, I didn't tell you the evening show. So the evening show has two parts,
evening
too.
Bad.
So from well, like 7 to 8:30, George is going to do a concert, right? So there'll be a set from George.
Awesome.
And then from, or that was like to 8:15, and then 8:30 to 10, we're going to do an extravaganza. So if you haven't been to an SGU extravaganza, they're a ton of fun. It's basically like a skeptical SGU variety show. And if you have been to one before, come again, because every show is different. No two extravaganzas are the same. They are designed that way. So it'll be like you're seeing it again for the first time. Such that you'll be able to get tickets for the day or the evening or a discount if you get both. But we'll have all that information online. By the way, it's going to be in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I don't know if you mentioned that, which is where George lives.
That's right. And maybe we'll give everyone a tour of George's bedroom.
Yeah.
I was going to say, no stalking George. Yeah, right.
Here's the night table. Here's the switch for the light.
The other exciting thing is that we're actually doing good onto our next two goals. Like we actually got quite a number of people that showed their support. And, you know, the big goal that Steve keeps talking about is at 4,000 patrons, we're going to do a 12-hour live show. And as soon as we get within what we think is going to be, you know, 3 to 6 month range of when that'll happen, we will contact the Star Trek Museum and try to start making arrangements.
We're making good progress, right? If this rate keeps up, this will definitely happen this year if we keep up the current pace.
Easily. Yeah, that's right, Kara.
Kara, yes. Calm down. Kara, calm down.
I'm so excited. Yeah.
Listen.
No, seriously, at this pace, if it keeps up, that's a big if, we're looking at a summer event.
Yep. Now, look, we're close enough that I'm actually already summer. Looking up costuming for this event. That's how close we are.
Oh, yeah.
Don't let Jay fool you. He's always looking up.
Oh, really, Jay? You've taken that big step. Whoa. Star Trek costumes, huh? What's next, props?
Yeah. Oh, I fully admit the props thing I'm going berserk on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got the Star Trek chairs are in the works right now. They'll be on our set very soon. So if you're interested in becoming a patron, you can go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and you can see our video that Steve and I made that'll tell you everything that you need to know, and all the information is also on that page.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve. Sure, man.
Thanks,
Steve.
Thank
you, Doctor.
You got it, man.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.